Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Caleb Carr is the critically acclaimed author of The Alienist, The Angel of Darkness, The Lessons of Terror, and many other novels. He has taught military history at Bard College and worked extensively in film, television, and theater. Demonstrating the rich storytelling, plotting, and depth of research that he showcased in The Alienist, Carr has written a new novel, The Legend of Broken. Some years ago, a remarkable manuscript long rumored to exist was discovered, The Legend of Broken. It tells of a prosperous fortress city where order reigns at the point of a sword, even as scheming factions secretly vie for control of the surrounding kingdom. Meanwhile, outside the city's granite walls, an industrious tribe of exiles known as the Bane forages for sustenance in the wilds. It is a great pleasure to welcome Caleb Carr to The Book Show.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Very nice to have you with us. Give us a sense of what brought you to this type of book. Is this something that you have long thought of doing, of going into a fantasy genre?
I first started this book in about 1984, and it was one of those projects that I kept coming back to and kept coming back to in between projects. And it was never the right time because of the fact that we were still living in an age of such pigeonholing. And really, you know, you can describe it as fantasy in that it takes place in an imaginary place. But it's not fantasy in the sense that you're not going to see any dragons or the wizards or anything like that. The whole emphasis of the book is on reality, the reality of the time, and how the reality in the Dark Ages could have been different had certain historical trends not taken place. It's always been an allegory, but it's funny how allegories grow. J.R.R. Tolkien spent most of his life trying to deny the fact and live down the fact that Lord of the Rings might be an allegory for World War II, for the interwar period in World War II. Well, it was obviously an allegory for that, but the mistake he made was that it was an allegory for a great deal more than that at the same time. And that's what happens with allegories. It's when I started in 84, I was living in New York, and it started out as an allegory about New York City, and then it grew in its scope, and it grew in its depth, in its philosophical depth, so that now it's an allegory for many things. The one thing I didn't want to do was have magic in it, because I've always found magic to be a terrible contrivance that you can work your way in and out of situations literally by magic. When we finally got to a place in publishing where those people kept saying over and over again, well, it's a great book. We would publish it, but we'd have to have magic in it. You know, we don't know what to do with it otherwise. We don't know where it fits. And then there came a point at which the lines of between genres got blurred, which was a good thing. The lines between genre fiction got blurred, and the lines between literary and popular fiction got blurred. One of the things that scares me the most about the book world now is we seem to be slipping back into a phase where everything is highly regimented. And that's due, of course, to the nature of the companies that are buying up the book world, the book publishing world, and their desire to sell books as if they were any other product. And books really aren't any other product. They are a distinct phenomenon unto themselves, and you just can't run it by the business model.
Give us a sense of why name alone isn't enough for a writer. You would think after The Alienist, and you have a huge hit, that your name would be enough to say, okay, here is my idea. But you still have that, you have to have the hook of where to put it in the bookstore.
Oh, yeah. They still very much. I remember there was a funny incident I was in Scotland once, talking at a bookstore in Edinburgh, and a very good Scottish mystery writer came to the thing. He asked me this kind of bitter question. He said to me, "What? How do you feel about the fact that the Alienist novels get put into the fiction section of the store as well as the mystery section of the store. And he really felt it was a slight that he was not put into both as well. It's that kind of regimentation was still very strong in the industry, and it was a conscious effort. I mean, The Alienist was, in among many things, a conscious effort to try to break down those walls. And I don't pretend that I was alone in doing it, but there was a tremendous effort to try to do that. And it did happen for a little while, but with the rise of the internet and ebooks, it seems like people need to have the regimentation again. They need to know where they go to get what they get. So you don't go to McDonald's for Kentucky Fried Chicken. It's that kind of thing, which is a sad sort of slip backwards, I think.
The thing I love about this novel, and what I find fascinating about literature in general, is that you as an artist are able to create a world. And yes, it is a magic-free zone, but you have still created this incredible world.
It's still an imaginary world. It just works by real terms.
Now that, to me, would seem obviously a lot of work. But also, it seems to me, it would be tremendous fun to create that. Where you are not mired in, okay, this is history, this is fact, this is my imagination.
Yeah, the problem is once you say, I'm going to make it work by real terms, then you have to say, well, how far are you going to take that? And everything outside of this little world you've created has got to be real. And it's a terrible curse doing these books because you always go into it. I went into The Alienist thinking, oh, this will be easier than writing history because I'm writing historical fiction. Of course, it was as hard as history and as hard as fiction, both. I mean, it was an incredibly challenging project. In this one, I thought, well, this will be easier because it's just the product of my imagination. But then I had everything in it and around it that had to function according to what we know about that age. So it became extremely difficult as well in terms of research.
It begins with a manuscript that is long rumored to exist, and this document is discovered, and it is remarkable. And that sort of gets us rolling.
Yeah, that's a kind of tip of the hat, too. There's a lot of tips of the hat to not contemporary authors, really, but older authors. That's kind of a tip of the hat to Robert Graves and I Claudius with the buried manuscript. And I make no pretense that, you know, I'm not tipping my hat because I want people to know about those other, some of them are mentioned in the back of the book. I want people to know about, you know, the whole idea of the lost city, the disappeared city. That harkens very strongly back to, I think the Wall Street Journal guy was smart enough to say that harkens back very much to H. Rider Haggard and Arthur Conan Doyle, that kind of lost world. That's what it was supposed to do. And that's a rich tradition that's been kind of lost in magic. Because in those stories, they were terribly concerned with having it appear to be real. King Solomon's Mines, the possibility had to exist. I like that. And the simple fact that we now know, you know, think we know what most of the history of the world is, well, there's a lot of it that we don't, not a lot, but there are pockets of it. And it so happened that in the 8th century in central northern Germany, that is one of those areas that we just don't know who was there and what language they spoke and what they did. It was a perfect setting for it.
Bring us to that place, to Germany, of what led you to, well, to that country and ultimately to that place.
Well, I think what led me to the country originally was seeing, you can't see the mountain of what's called Brocken in German, or what I changed to Broken for obvious allegorical reasons, but it has been the site since ancient times. It has been this mountain that has been considered accursed in some way, and the site of evil, terrible doings. Goethe in Faust set the Walpurgisnacht scene on that mountain. It's beautiful, but it's viewed with a great deal of, I don't want to say suspicion, but people are kind of iffy about it. Mm-hmm. And also at the same time, it was a mountain that was very similar to the mountain where I live. I live at the base of a mountain that's about just a little smaller than Brocken, and we're about at the same latitude, so that I could be here writing about there, and, you know, when I needed to get an effect in terms of being out in the forest as opposed to, you know, being out in any city, I could get that effect if I needed to feel like what it was like on the mountaintop. That's how it got fixed on that exact spot.
Caleb Carr's new book is The Legend of Brocken. It is published by Random House.
And then, as I said, there is the creation of this world and this legend and these people. And with your background in military history, in teaching this as a professor, of course, and in writing about it so extensively, that comes very much into play. It does,
because there are, one of the things I object to about fantasy novels, people are always telling me I should like fantasy novels because there are all these great huge battle scenes like in Lord of the Rings. And I tell people, my answer is, they're not battle scenes. They're just masses of people crashing into each other. There's no suggestion of any kind of thought behind how they should crash into each other. And that's no fault of Tolkien's. He was a linguistics professor. I mean, you know, he was his big point was to create a new language. But my point was partly to show what we do know of the world as it existed outside this city-state that I've created, and then also the citizens of this city-state took their cue. Basically, their founder had served as a mercenary with the Romans. They took their cue very much from the Romans and yet gave it their own national tint. So it was fun. It was great fun for me to sort of create a synthesis out of those two military traditions. But that really was only one of the strands of the book. I mean, by the time I had finished, I had to do similar amounts of research with medicine, with metallurgy. I mean, it goes on and on. The science I had to learn that would have been possible, that a little like The Alienist in, you know, that book concerned what's the earliest we could have identified the serial killer? And this is really more what's the earliest we could have seen progress if, you know, people had been brave enough to make significant progress and brave the punishments, because the punishments were very severe. Between the 6th century and the 16th century, scientific progress was dead in Europe because of the influence of the various monotheistic religions that stamped it out.
And in your book, science really defies all expectations.
Yes. It defies all expectations by echoing some things that are still, we still use today, that are still controversial today, weaponry that would have been available to someone with a really good command of chemistry, explosives, and that part of it appealed to me too, that there were comments to be made on how our armed forces conduct themselves within the context of an 8th century story. That part I really liked.
And again, I mean, back to the fortress city, and that story is always interesting to me, but those who are inside and those who are out and those who want to get in and those who want to get out.
Right.
That's endlessly fascinating and probably always will be.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, it's the old Shakespearean thing about the city and the wild and the forest that surrounds it, you know, and who and how much fluidity is there in and out, and what happens in which sphere, you know, and people have to leave the city to attain a certain kind of basic enlightenment that they may have forgotten about, and people outside the city are always dying to get in to enjoy the pleasures and the profits. So it is, and it is an endlessly fascinating story. It's one, but again, it's one we've largely lost because people think there's no place left. I mean, there's no place left to go. In many sense, a friend of mine once said to me, you know, history is really the last exotic place on earth. Because we can sit at home and watch anything, travelogues, beautiful, you know, high definition pictures of any place on earth. But what you can't watch is the past. And that is sort of a, in a moment, he kind of summed up what I've been doing for the last 20 years. It is the last exotic place, and it is the place you can go that it's different for every person. Every person experiences the past differently. It's full of characters who are exotic, yet totally credible. Action that's totally credible. I mean, it's that part of it I really love. Of course, that results in extra research. So, you know, this took twice as much research as The Alienist did. Once you're in it, it's you know, it's like your own private Vietnam. It's just you're in it and you can't get out. You know, it's just. Well, I can't turn back and say I don't really want to do this project. So the only way, I think the apocryphal phrase that was attributed to Winston Churchill, if you find yourself going through hell, keep going, which I think they don't know whether he said it or not.
So do you feel as a writer you have come out victorious in the sense of that it is the story you wanted to tell?
Oh yes, that part of it I'm very happy about. You know, it will if previous books like it are any judge, it may take some people some time to get into the book. I mean, any of these books. I mean, it was the same thing with The Alienist. I had dozens of people, readers and reviewers, saying, "Well, the beginning was hard to get into, then it was great." Because the beginning is always hard to get into. You know, when you're creating an alternate reality, you have to set the terms for everybody. So that part's always hard. But I think once you get past that part, I think people will be rewarded. But I certainly have been rewarded by having it done.
One of the things that struck me about the book is that when you compare it to much of your other work, where there was a relatively small cast and very controllable, This is a doorstop of a book, and it has a very large cast. There's a lot to keep track of.
Yes, there is a lot to keep track of. And believe me, my study at home was, all walls were plastered with, you know, storylines that you just have to keep simultaneously going. You know, but you're in for what you're in for. It never seems that way when you start. You know, you get into these huge worlds. Even The Alienist, it was a huge different world than anything we know now. And you get into it and you think, well, I can handle this. And then you just get deeper and deeper into the details, and you're just like, well, we got to include this. I have to include this. I have to. And before you know it, you've got, you know, a whole big cast of characters and a whole lot of material to cover with them. But hopefully you do it in a fun way.
much of this, when we think of fantasy, we think of series, we think of stories that go on, because once this world is created, there's much more to find out about the life that goes on within and outside of those walls. Did you ever think that way? I can split this up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I don't think I'm telling tales out of school by saying that I was told by my publisher that the words book one or part one would not appear on the cover of this book. At this book, it was a necessity that this book stand on its own, and then depending on what the reaction was, maybe we'd do another one down the road. Now, there's a lot of reasons why they had that opinion. At the time that they voiced it, they weren't doing so good with fantasy series, and I probably shouldn't get more specific than that, but they had, Random House had waited a very long time for the latest installment of a certain fantasy series, and they were tired of it, and they didn't want to see any more books that where you had to look down the line to get the story. But the door is left open in this book. The
absolutely,
door is clearly
yeah.
left open.
And it's open for you. I mean, you're willing to go there if the interest is there. The reviews I've read of this book, I find fascinating because so many people talk about it as a departure, and I don't know if I see it as really that much of a departure in that it has all of your hallmarks.
You are wise not to see it as a departure because it isn't. It just goes back, you know, okay, it goes back 1,000 years before the 1890s, but it is much more of a historical mystery than it is a fantasy in the traditional senses. I mean, what they're trying to figure out, what all this great cast of characters, the different things they're trying to figure out are all real. And they all involve, you know, specialized cognitive thinking rather than magic or impulse. So it's really not a departure at all, but it's very hard to get people to see that if they don't take a look at it.
I just have to ask you, because I'm curious, but when they first showed you the cover and there is this white tiger creature coming to you, did you like
the panther.
That? The panther. Did you like that?
I actually, for the most part, designed that cover.
That's a beautiful cover.
Because they wanted one iconic figure from the book. And you couldn't, there was no one person. And yet the soul of the book is really wrapped up in that white panther.
It's riveting stuff. It's The Legend of Broken is the new book. It is published by Random House. Caleb Carr, great pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
A great pleasure and honor. Caleb Carr's new book is The Legend of Broken. It is published by Random House. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our programs. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.